Jessica?
Hey, so, I was a reporter at the Toronto Star, the largest newspaper in Canada, and spent much of the last year covering oil transport issues. If you told me a couple years before that that would become my obsession, I would have thought you were crazy. But it became clear in the last year just how important these things are. Last July, on a Saturday morning, I got a call from my editor wondering if I would jump in the car and drive 8 or 9 hours to a small town east of Montreal in Quebec where there had been a train crash. At that time, we didn't really know much about it. We knew a train had derailed and that it was on fire. And we actually discussed over the phone that it may be a total waste of time. This might not be a very big story. You may get there and just turn around and drive home and your whole weekend's shot. And I said, well, whatever, okay, we'll go. It became clear after getting there very quickly that this was a big story. The fires burned for several days. The number of missing people in those first few days was about 200. And every time there was a press conference, the actual death toll got higher and higher and higher. So in the end, there was about 6 million liters of oil spilled into the environment, into the waterways of the town, the sewage systems, the river that flowed past it. The entire downtown core was decimated. There was dozens of buildings just completely flattened, and 47 people were killed. Lac-Mégantic, I think, brought to light a lot of issues and things that have been happening over the last few years that most of us were not aware of. Certainly not the general public and probably not most journalists either. Oil by rail shipments increased dramatically in the last 5 or so years. And that's a result of production booms in Alberta and the oil sands in Canada, as well as in the Bakken region in North Dakota. Pipeline capacity isn't enough pipeline capacity to move the oil, and so for years rail had been picking up the slack. The type of oil being moved also is different. One of the first press conferences the safety investigators did in Lac-Mégantic, a big source of questioning was why the oil exploded and why it was still on fire. And they were at a loss, just like journalists. And everybody was sort of going, but crude oil doesn't behave this way. Much later, it became clear from federal investigations in the States that Bakken crude is very light and more volatile than what we would consider traditional oil. And that also became clear in the States afterwards with a number of other derailments and explosions. I think it also brought to light the regulatory regime, which certainly in Canada has moved towards self-regulation and has come under a lot of criticism for federal regulators not providing enough oversight of that self-regulation. And it hadn't changed to reflect the increase in the amount of oil being transported. The train that derailed in Lac-Mégantic had been operated by a one-man crew. It had been left unattended with about 70 cars of crude oil running with the cab unlocked, all of which was fine under the rules. It also had an insufficient number of brakes, unfortunately. The oil was carried in DOT 111 tank cars that had been flagged as dangerous and prone to rupture from as early as 1996, and yet there had been no regulatory changes for that. There have been a lot of changes in Canada and in the States since Lac-Mégantic, and at least some of those gaps have probably been closed, and there's likely to be a lot more regulatory changes coming. But there's a huge public concern about this. It's something that I think people were totally unaware of until Lac-Mégantic happened, and that every day, sitting in a newsroom, you get calls from people who are sitting in their apartment window and watching black tank cars go by right outside their homes, and they're really, really scared. And with pipelines as well, people suddenly are noticing, and they're calling when they see the little pipeline markers going through the city and saying, whoa, why is that right beside the subway? So I think for journalists, this is a huge issue, and it's one that our readers, our listeners, our viewers are really, really interested in. And it's also hugely important. I mean, Lac-Mégantic, and in terms of pipelines, the spill in Marshall, Michigan, really showed us what the consequences can be of oil transport if it's not done safely, if something goes wrong. Oil transport is economy, it's energy, it's jobs, and it's also our environment, it's our communities, and it's our lives. It's going to, production is in the foreseeable future, it's going to continue to increase, and that means it's going to continue to need to be transported, whether it's by rail, by truck, by pipeline. It's going to be going through our communities. So I think we know now how devastating it can be when that doesn't go well. And as journalists, it's contingent on us to learn as much as we can, to inform our readers as much as we can, and to make sure that there's that scrutiny there, that to make sure it's done safely.
Okay, thank you very much. Perfect. Bob, could you take a swing at it from the perspective of the oil industry, explain exactly how the production ramped up to the degree it has, and the challenge the basis of getting it to refinery and market?
Sure, happy to. My name is Bob Greco with the American Petroleum Institute. Thank you for having me here, and it's a pleasure to be here with you all today. I'm going to focus mostly on rail in my remarks, but we can certainly talk about pipeline, marine, other things as you see fit. Let me open first by saying that in regards to safety, whether it's safely moving, safely refining, safely producing the products that we all need to live our lives, safety is a core value of the oil and gas industry. We take it very seriously. And our goal is zero incidents at all times. And we look at rail shipments right now, we move about 99.997% of hazardous materials, which includes crude oil, without incident. Now, that's not zero yet. So we need to look at how we can squeeze that last 0.003% of risk out of the system. So how do we do that? Well, as you all know, the Department of Transportation has just made a proposal for improving rail safety. And what they've done, at our urging, we hope, is look at this holistically. When I say holistically, you have to look at preventing accidents, you have to look at mitigating them, and you also have to look at how you respond to them. All three of those are integrally important if you want to improve safety. And also, any effort to improve safety has to be data-driven and has to be made in the context of actually reducing risk and not displacing it or shifting it somewhere else. Just for example, you had a heavier make a tank car heavier. That means you're shipping more crude oil and more tank cars. Is that actually reducing risk? It's a fair question to ask that needs to be addressed by the regulators when you're looking at that in the context of improving rail safety. So let me talk about prevention, mitigation, and response. On the prevention side, we're working with the railroad industry and regulators to look at some of the factors that Jessica talked about. Whether it's crewing, whether it's track operations and maintenance, tank car conditions, those are really the rail industry's purview. So ultimately, they're the experts on that. We're providing the assistance we can to them on that, but that's really their area of expertise and is one that needs to be looked at clearly in looking at the three-legged stool. I'll skip mitigation and come back to that. That's going to be the most of the discussion. On emergency response, when responding after an accident, under federal law, the railroads have the responsibility to respond to any accident that's caused as a result of a railroad. We are working with the railroad industry as well as regulators to improve an already robust system in place under the Oil Pollution Act of 1990. We've got very extensive requirements in place, but what else can we do in that regard? For example, educating first responders is a priority because, as Jessica alluded to, oil is moving in different directions than it used to. And first responders may not be aware of that, and they need to have the materials and information about crude oil properties to properly respond in the event of an accident. So we're working with them, working through TransCare, which is a national network of first responders, to help provide that information to the first responders who need it. Now let me talk about mitigation. Mitigation is primarily tank car design and crude oil properties, so I'll focus on that, because that really is within the oil and gas industry's purview, more so than the other two. We alluded to the 111 tank cars. I'll throw a few numbers at you. Those are the old DOT tank cars that have been approved for probably 20 or 30 years, I believe. The oil industry, shippers, rail industry have petitioned PHMSA multiple times in the past 3 or 4 years to improve the tank car design. In the face of a lack of action, the industries went ahead with a voluntary standard called the CPC 1232. We've been making those tank cars since 2011. Time state-of-the-art tank cars, thicker shells, head shields, thermal blankets, better improved bottom and outlets and top fittings, things that improve the safety over the 111 tank cars. We are making those cars right now. About 40% of the tank car fleet are these 1232 cars. And by next year, about 60% would be. So when you're looking at moving forward on tank car design, you have to look at two things. You have to look at what's appropriate for new tank cars going forward. Do we need an even better standard for new tank car design? And secondly, what do you do with the existing tank car fleet that we've been building? New tank cars, we're working again with the rails and PHMSA. We're looking at what we can do to make new tank cars safer. Can we thicken the tank shell? What can we do to add full height head shields, make some of these improvements I've just talked about, so that all new builds going forward are required to have that? Remember, the 1232 is a voluntary standard. DOT never adopted it. So industry is a bit vulnerable because we've built tank cars that are newer, safer, better, but they haven't been fully blessed by the government yet. So what can we do? So we're looking at what we do on the new tank cars. Older tank cars, we've got the 111s, we've got the 1232s that are in the fleet. We're looking at those and saying, what can you do to reduce the risk the most in retrofits? So if you were to retrofit them, you ought to be focusing on the 111 tank cars first. Those are the older tank cars. Those are the ones where you get the greatest risk reduction if you retrofit them. So we're also looking at the 1232s, and we're trying to see what makes sense to retrofit these tank cars to reduce the risk in their operations. In doing so, you have to look at a few factors. Probably the most important one, once you agree on what are the changes you make, is shop capacity. These are tank cars that have to be taken out of service, brought into a repair shop, retrofitted, and put back into service. We are not the experts on that, but we've been consulting with the experts, the Railway Supply Institute. And based on current shop capacity, if you were to prioritize and do an update, oil cars only, you're probably looking at a three to four year schedule to retrofit all of the existing oil tank car fleets while also building new tank cars. So you remember, you got the dual track going. So any activity the DOT takes has to be cognizant of that and allow those retrofits to occur. And that's important because these rail cars are critical to our energy economy, our security. As you all know, this is an energy renaissance. We've changed in the past 6 years. We've moved from mostly importing our crude oil to mostly producing our own at this point. We're the number one producer in liquids, number one producer in natural gas in the world. We're an energy powerhouse now. And if you look at Canada, U.S., and Mexico together, we can be energy self-sufficient in this continent within 10 years. That's a huge change from where we were just 10 years ago. So we want to make sure that whatever we do going forward doesn't jeopardize that ongoing renaissance. So that's what I'd like to cover on tank cars. Let me talk a little bit about crude oil. There is an existing crude oil right now is classified as a flammable liquid. No surprise, it is a flammable liquid. It's classed as one. There are other classifications. There are corrosives, there are acids, there are nuclear, there are explosives. These are all things that need additional shipping, and DOT has requirements for all those. We're in the flammable liquids class. We measure that by initial boiling point. We measure that by flash. You'll sense the theme of collaboration through all this. To develop an API standard. API does 500 plus industry standards worldwide. We're developing a voluntary industry standard on classification, testing, and loading and unloading of crude oil. What can we do to make improvements to make sure that we're more accurately characterizing it and handling it in a better fashion? That standard should hopefully be out in about a month or so. We've been working on that since, I think, February. Which, if you ever work on a standard, this is light speed. It takes years to do standards. We're going to be putting out one in about 6 to 8 months. So we're working with the top scientists, top engineers, and the companies in the industry. Again, the regulators are at the table with us to move forward on that. In the meantime, again, we think these are properly classed and handled the way they should be. As Jessica mentioned, Bakken crude is a light sweet crude, as opposed to Canadian, which is a heavy sweet crude. I'm not sure which crude is just right. But we have light, we have heavy. Crude runs the gamut. Bakken crude is lighter. However, Bakken crude is not significantly different than other light crudes that we ship. So we are looking at that from the standpoint. I mean, this has been confirmed by multiple different independent examinations of the data. We test the data, we look at it, and this is a light crude and it behaves like other light crudes. So we provide that information to PHMSA. And again,
say what PHMSA is.
I'm sorry, too many acronyms. This is going to be a tough one.
Pipeline Hazardous Materials Safety Administration.
I just use spinball. Thank you.
Pipeline Hazardous Materials Safety Administration. It's within the DOT universe, and that's, I think, something we'll discuss before the end of the session. It just as it's very helpful reporters to know all the different agencies that are involved, the Federal Railroad Administration, and it just there are lots of different components here.
So again, I think I'll just wrap it up there, and I'm sure we'll have plenty of time for questions afterwards.
Thank you. So now I want to ask Lois about Bob's observation about becoming an energy powerhouse, and if that's a really good thing, because I think that maybe you have a little bit of a different perspective on that from the environmental advocacy.
Yeah, I'll touch on that. Thanks, Mike, and thanks to my fellow presenters and to all you for attending this. My name is Lois Epstein. I'm an engineer. I'm also Arctic Program Director for the Wilderness Society. I started out my career in Washington, D.C. I'm now in Alaska and have been since 2001. I also was a former consultant, and to give you a little information about the Wilderness Society, we are a national public interest conservation organization with around 500,000 members and supporters nationwide. My work involves protecting what we characterize as special areas and ensuring that oil and gas operations are safe and as environmentally sound as possible. And a natural question is, what is a special area? How do we decide what areas are worthy of protection? And we look at their ecological, their wilderness, subsistence, cultural, recreational, and or visual qualities. And primarily we work to protect federal lands and to ensure that those areas that should be federal lands are protected. And if there is oil and gas development or other types of development on those lands, that it's done right. In the back, I have some colleagues here in the room as well, but there's a Too Wild to Drill publication, and that lays out the types of places that we are working to protect. There are 12 examples across the country. To answer Mike's question and to lay out some of the key trends and facts across the country in terms of oil development, I'll start by talking about shale oil production. It's different than what historically has been known as conventional oil production in areas like Texas or Alaska. It occurs in different places. I'm sure everyone's heard about what's going on in North Dakota in the Bakken Shale, but it's also occurring in Texas and other areas. I would encourage people to pay attention to what's going to be happening in Mexico, where the geology flows over from Texas, and their policies are changing to allow outside investment. So that's another area where shale oil, through the use of hydraulic fracturing and directional drilling, is going to be bumping up in the next few years. One of the things I do is work on hydraulic fracturing and the regulatory response, both at the federal and the state level. There is a fact sheet that I worked on that's in the back called Misleading Statements about Hydraulic Fracturing that you might hear in your work as you're looking at that issue. And I give the response about why those are misleading. An example might be the concept that we have to have the states regulate hydraulic fracturing because it's different in each state in terms of the geology. Historically, the way we've done regulation for things like drilling is to have a federal minimum, and then states can adjust to serve their needs. And I would argue the same thing ought to be done for hydraulic fracturing. The Bureau of Land Management has proposed its own regulations for hydraulic fracturing on its own lands, on federal lands, to cover things like well integrity. That's been opposed by the U.S. House of Representatives, and they've encouraged, basically they passed a bill that said that if states have regulations or even guidelines, then that would trump the federal requirements. We disagree with that position and think we have a strong technical basis for where we stand. And then in general, I'm sure everybody recognizes that oil producers are going to go where the oil is. And in terms of shale oil, that's primarily on private lands, not on federal lands. But that's not the rhetoric that you're going to be hearing from the industry, which is constantly trying to open up more and more federal lands onshore and offshore for drilling. And just a few facts that on Bureau of Land Management lands, as of 2013, there are over 36 million acres that are leased for drilling, but only approximately 12.6 million acres are in production. We like that figure because it shows that the industry is very interested in having these leases, which don't cost them a lot, but that doesn't mean they're actually going to drill there. But there is this ongoing push to continue to open up more and more land to make it available to them. Additionally, there are over 6,700 approved applications for permits to drill that are not being used by the industry. So there's this, you know, again, this big push for the ability to drill, but not necessarily to go forward with that because they're going to go where the oil is. An interesting trend line that I think is important in the broader context is that oil imports in the United States have been decreasing, as is overall oil use in the U.S. But what you are going to hear is we need to reduce imports. That's incredibly important. And that's really an artifact of when we were much more dependent on Middle Eastern oil. Right now, the largest import source is Canada, and we're going down. So, you know, the trend lines there are very different than they used to be, but the rhetoric hasn't changed. In terms of, and to get to your question, Mike, about the whether we are an energy powerhouse, I have no problem with the U.S. Producing oil and trying to make ourselves continentally, you know, including Canada, as self-sufficient as possible. I like the trend lines. I like the fact that we are using less. I like the fact that we are importing less, but in a free trade world, you know, there's no real problem with importing and exporting. You know, we need in terms of the United States, we just need to be sure that our drilling is done the right way and in the right places. That's our position on that. In terms of the environmental impacts, just very briefly, I'll go through this. I'm happy to talk more to anybody that would like more details, having worked on this issue for about, over 20 years. It's an industry that, unfortunately, is very, very dirty. You're dealing with a non-homogeneous material. So there are going to be oil spills. There are going to be periodic major oil spills, even blowouts. Cleanup, particularly when you're talking offshore or when you're talking about tar sands, oil sands, oil, which does have different characteristics than conventional oil. And if that gets into water, it's going to be very tough. And recovery of the oil is going to be a fairly small percentage. In the process of drilling, you're going to have waste drilling muds, waste rock cuttings, produce water, which is what comes up from the subsurface. It's also put down through the process of hydraulic fracturing, which uses a lot of water. It uses a lot of chemicals, so you're going to have a fair amount of wastewater. Much of it likely in areas should be reinjected if it's possible. It isn't always possible. So in general, there's going to be a lot of waste that need to be managed properly. In terms of using water, that could have impacts on fish, certainly could have impacts on groundwater. There's always going to be air quality issues, whether it's pollution, pollutants like nitrogen oxides or sulfur oxides. You're going to have black carbon. You have noise issues. You're going to have safety issues associated with drilling. Road development impacts, typically roads and drilling go together. You're going to have wildlife habitat breakup. In Alaska, where we're still actually building long roads to areas that are not developed, you're going to have subsistence impacts. You're going to have new people coming into areas that had previously were inaccessible to them. And then certainly in terms of greenhouse gases, we're all well aware that burning of the produced oil is going to add to climate change problems. pipeline impacts, two categories. You have the construction-related impacts where you can have ecosystem damage, particularly associated with stream crossings, very sensitive areas. In terms of pipeline operations, you will have minor or major oil spills depending on how the pipelines are being operated, associated with corrosion, other causes. I've done a number of reports on pipeline records in Alaska. A lot of these things don't get out into the media because you have to really dig into the data that the states collect. And if you have inadequate leak detection under valve placement and there aren't sufficient requirements on that, you're going to get bigger spills than you would if you had. And companies voluntarily sometimes put in place the right measures, but that's, you can't rely on that. In terms of rail, of course, the big issue is safety. But if you do have a derailment or a release, you don't always have materials under pressure the way you do with pipelines. So pipelines, in many cases, can result in much more major environmental damages. Safety-wise, I think what we've seen in the past year or two is that rail has more significant safety issues than pipelines do. I actually have on my paper, and Bob mentioned it, you know, a response to the 99%+ transported safely, you know, and I've been talking about that figure that's been laid out for many years. My response to that is that less than 2% of one day's use of oil in the U.S. was released by the Exxon Valdez tragedy in 1989 when it hit an iceberg and spilled into Prince William Sound. But I don't think anybody, no matter what your position, would say that that was okay. So really the 99%+ might give you some a feeling of comfort, but what matters is how much is released and where it's released and when. And then in terms of social impacts, new areas that are being drilled, you're going to have population increases. This is what happens to communities. It's going to be disproportionately men in these small communities, especially rural communities. Potential social problems associated with the increased crime, people without a lot to do on their days off, housing shortages, increased costs for residents, legal and illegal competition for hunted wildlife and fishing resources in the area. Basically, what's been documented, particularly in places like Wyoming with the coal bed methane and areas that have not had these boom economies, is that there's very serious changes in their ways of life associated with drilling booms. So maybe that's another answer to your question about what it means to be an energy powerhouse. So I'm going to end with four different needs that I see. First, I believe we really need to have effective hydraulic fracturing requirements. Right now, we've got drilling being pushed forward very, very quickly. The regulators are behind, whether it's state or federal. That's an absolute need in the near term. I discussed a little bit about BLM's not yet finalized proposal to do that. That's something we're very anxious to see finalized in the near term. So at least on federal lands, there are strong well integrity, chemical disclosure, and wastewater management requirements. Second, there's a very large need for upgraded pipeline safety rules. And there I really fault the current administration for having not done its job. In 2010, there was an advance notice of proposed rulemaking. I spent a long time developing comments. I have colleagues in industry who said they spent 6 months developing comments on that. It is in the black hole of the federal government. It has not even reached the proposal stage. You know, what kind of changes are needed in pipeline safety? And who knows what will come out, but we have basically all that work has been for naught if we don't even get a proposed rule, much less a final rule out, and it's a shame. And during that time, since 2010, there have been a number of very serious and tragic oil transmission pipeline accidents. Jessica mentioned the Michigan, Marshall, Michigan tar sands accident. The incident, many years of recovery, and we've learned how difficult it is to recover tar sands oil once it gets into in this case, the Kalamazoo River. Mayflower, Arkansas, a suburb of a larger community, I think it's Little Rock in Arkansas, that large oil transmission pipeline release, very problematic. Mayflower? Yeah, is it Little Rock?
Mayflower, yeah.
Yeah, but is it a suburb of Little Rock? That's what I wasn't sure about. Yeah, okay. The Yellowstone River in Montana was subject to a big spill. Outside of Salt Lake City, there were several oil transmission pipeline incidents. So this does happen, and it has strong, you know, serious consequences to these communities. And the federal government has, PHMSA, now that we know what it stands for, has not done its job, in my view. Certainly, third is the upgraded rail transportation rules. There has been some progress. We heard a little bit about some of the voluntary measures industry has taken. I don't have problems with voluntary measures. I just don't think they're enough. I don't think they're structured to be enforceable. I'm by nature, in terms of my job, impatient. I think that we really need to move forward and have some mandatory requirements. Voluntary is slow. And then fourth, in terms of needs, from a climate change standpoint, we're going to have to keep some oil in the ground. The question is where, if we want to mitigate some of the most serious consequences of climate change. That's what the science tells us. And in my view, areas like the Arctic Ocean, where there's extreme risk associated with oil development, right now there's not infrastructure in place. Those are some of the best places to not go forward with a massive new oil and potentially gas development, because the easiest time to make a decision like that, even though it's still a very hard decision, is before the industry has started and invested in moving forward. I would also argue, in terms of another area where we really do need to reduce our ongoing oil development, is the tar sands area of Canada, because of the disproportionately high greenhouse gases associated with each barrel of oil produced. So I wanted to thank folks in the audience and all the reporters here for all you do to ensure that accurate information is available to policymakers and to the public. It's a critical function, critical role you play, and it's really appreciated.
Okay, what I want to do now is have a little bit of a directed discussion up here, more of a conversation, and then open it up to questions from the journalists in the audience. One of the things that I got involved from a reporter point of view, last April 30th, a train derailed in downtown Lynchburg, and it... It was a unit train of more than 100 tanker cars filled with up to about 30,000 gallons each. 17 cars derailed. Three of them went right into the James River, because the track runs along the James. It really basically follows the old James River and Kanawha River, Kanawha Canal system. So it's a historic relic. It was right through downtown Lynchburg. One car, it turns out, caught on fire. About 30,000 gallons was released either into the air or into the river. It was a very lucky, it turns out to be a very lucky moment. And it doesn't sound like it, but if it had gone to the other side, we might have had something similar to Lac-Mégantic. Not on that scale, because the train was going 25 miles an hour, not 63. It wasn't a runaway train. But it's right through downtown Lynchburg. In Richmond, it goes right past the water treatment plant. It goes along the James. It goes over the outer edge of an island along the James. That's part of the park system, where there will be tens of thousands of people there next month for the Richmond Folk Festival. It goes right over an elevated track over the most historic and oldest part of the city, on its way to through the middle of Williamsburg to a terminal in Yorktown that used to be a refinery. It's now owned by Plains Marketing out of Houston. And it's a storage and transfer terminal, and then they load the crude onto barges and barge it up to Philadelphia primarily, but refineries in the Northeast. And barges are part of this discussion. We haven't really mentioned them, but I understand it's a real issue. For example, in the Hudson River, a lot of shipments coming down from Albany, and the barge traffic is also an issue with this stuff. So from a reporter's perspective, We have something unfolding on the ground, and all of a sudden there would have been the National Transportation Safety Board, which is another of the alphabet soups you need to know. The NTSB is an important agency because they investigate the accidents and they make recommendations. It takes a long time, about a year, but their recommendations tend not to pull their punches. The problem is that it takes a long time for anything to happen as a result of their recommendations. So they had a rail safety forum the week before about this issue. So timing is everything. And I think that all of a sudden, as reporters, we're learning about this phenomenon, that we're talking about trains of 100 cars, unit trains of 100 cars each, 105 in this case, going an estimated, right now, 4 to 6 times a week, but it could end up, they're talking about 800 trains a year. Is it a bad thing? Probably not from an economic perspective, energy security perspective, but there are a lot of dangers. It's going right through some of the most sensitive areas in Virginia, environmentally, as well as major population centers. So as part of what I've tried to do is educate myself as a reporter, and I really want to try to help. A lot of you may know a lot more than I did about this, but I think it's good to focus on a few things. First of all, you're talking about volume. If you talk to the firefighters and emergency officials, they'll say, the crude, we have a lot of flammable and hazardous things that go through rail shipments that go through our towns already. But we're not equipped to deal with something like Loch Megantic, where you have multiple cars on fire. It's not viscous crude, and so it spreads. It's harder for them to put foam on it if they had the foam to do it. So the volume is an issue, and the flammability is an issue. And as Bob said, this crude is considered class 3 flammable. But within that class, there are 3 packing groups. And the packing groups are based on volatility primarily, because this oil contains quite a bit of volatile gases. And from a firefighter's perspective, they're saying, well, packing group 1, packing group 2, we know it's crude. But the federal rulemaking that was announced in July would, if it's packing group 1, the most hazardous category, it would require the car, that oil to be transported in retrofitted cars or new cars that meet higher safety standards. And I think that's a critical issue that I'd like to hear a little discussion about, because there's some disagreement about whether we're really dealing with something different or not. I mean, Jessica saw on the ground, it was something different. And for the firefighters, it's not so much something different except for the volume of it. One of the things that I'd like to, as a tip to my fellow journalists, I found incredibly helpful the federal rulemaking they released on July 23rd, and you can find this on the Department of Transportation's website. They also released the results of what they called Operation Safe Delivery Update. It was an operation classification where they were classifying the oil. The Pipeline Safety Administration, Hazardous Material Safety Administration, and the Federal Railroad Administration did a joint investigation in North Dakota where the shale fields are, and they took samples, like 135 samples from the previous August through the end of May. And they characterized the oil. Now, from my perspective, this was like gold, because it had the company that owns the terminal in Yorktown would never return my calls, never return my emails. And they finally did, as I was working on a story that was published last week, and which was helpful, because I'm not trying to get them, I'm trying to get information. But this report says who owns the oil. And I found 4 samples that were owned by Plains that owns the Yorktown Terminal. One of those samples was taken the same day as the Lynchburg derailment. I said, okay, now I've got a connection. We look at it, it's all packing group one, the most flammable of in the class, 4.4% butane in it, a number of other volatile gases. So that's the sort of thing as a reporter you can work with. You say, okay, now you're responsible for the oil because all the focus had been on the railroad. One of the things that I think is an interesting point of discussion, I'll be interested to hear what Bob thinks of this, the railroad is quick to say, well, you know, we don't own the tanker cars. They don't own the train. They release them. Or they,
there's a mix.
The shippers basically, they own or lease. Planes, I think, owns or leases about 7,400 rail cars. So the railroads say, oh, fix the rail cars, better rail cars. And then Bob and the oil industry say, well, you know, keep the trains on the tracks and we won't have any problems. Which, so it's you see where the...
I did not say that, by the way.
No. Some people do. To say it's operational issues for rail, which is true. Track maintenance.
Well, I think that's why I said the three, you got to look at it holistically. Prevention, mitigation, and response, which is to your point. You have to look at all three if you really want to improve safety. You can't just take one in isolation, because that may not be effective.
So I'd like to hear the panel talk a little bit about this issue of what type of product we're dealing with and whether we have to deal with it differently than we deal with other products, given the fact that it's being shipped in such huge quantities through a barge. The trucks, I don't think, they're more for refined products, I think, a smaller scale. You know.
Areas that are close to shorter distances.
Right. There's some crude trucks, but it really is very localized because it's expensive to move it by truck. You get it to the railhead, to the port on the truck, and then let the long-haul transport pipeline, and then carry it the rest of the way.
And for those of you who are on the East Coast, working on the East Coast, the reason I discovered it, you know, the Keystone Pipeline really doesn't seem to me to affect directly this market because you're talking about a different product coming from Canada, and I may be wrong on that, Bob. So you correct me.
Yeah.
But the taking it down to the Gulf Coast eventually go up the Colonial Pipeline, the East Coast. But my understanding is the refineries in the East Coast are geared toward light crude, and they're like coming out of North Dakota. And even though shipping it by rail is more expensive, it's practically the way to do it. So you have to use the existing rail infrastructure, which, of course, goes through sensitive and populated areas. So what do you think, Bob, what about the volatility and the flammability? You've said that volatility is too narrow a measure. How should we be characterizing this oil?
Well, volatility is one element of looking at the risk of crude oil. Again, crude oil is a flammable liquid. It's not orange juice. It's going in the presence of a spark and oxygen, it will ignite. Therefore, it has to be treated specially, just as the other classifications. Whether there's a classification for shipping explosives by rail, for nuclear materials, corrosives, there's a category for flammable liquids. Right now, as we mentioned, it's measured by initial boiling point and flash point. What you're trying to do via the... I'm sorry, go ahead.
Can you define what those terms mean?
Initial boiling point is the temperature at which it first starts to boil. As I think Lois said, it's a heterogeneous mixture. So you've got... It's not like water that all boils at the same temperature. It boils over a range of temperatures. So when it first starts to boil, that's the initial boiling point. Flash point...
The lower the initial boiling point, the more flammable.
Yes, in general, yes. Now, I say in general because I'll give you some exceptions to that. The other issue is that the other metric is flash point, which is basically the I'll get this right. I'll take out my notes here, make sure I don't screw you up here, because I always get this one wrong. It's basically the temperature at which it could catch fire in the presence of an ignition source. So the lower the flash point, the more ignitable it is. So whether you use flammable, volatile, the fact is these are flammable liquids. You're trying to minimize the risk of a flammable liquid. Initial boiling point is kind of related to volatility. This whole discussion of is it more volatile, the regulations were actually changed in the early 90s. They used to measure what they call Reed vapor pressure, because volatility isn't a single term either. One way of measuring it is called reed vapor pressure. That's the pressure above the water, the pressure of the gas above the liquid at 100 degrees. So it's a PSI measure. That's one way of doing it. They switched in early 90s to the Department of Transportation to this initial boiling point, flash point, it's a better metric. Now there's talk about, do we need to reevaluate that and look at that? So that is where the discussion is right now on that. The issue, I think this issue of whether it's more volatile is a bit of a, is a little off point, because it's, you have to look at the volatility, I'll use volatility, in the context of other products. We're shipping, these are flammable liquids in the same tank, okay? You're shipping crude oil, which has a volatility, RVP, rate vapor pressure, of anywhere from 2 to 3 at the heavy end to maybe 15 at the high end. That's kind of the range. You say, well, that's a pretty big range, or PSI. In that same range, you've got ethanol, which is another flammable liquid, about 2-ish. Diesel, which is even lower. Then you got gasoline, which happens to overlap very well with crude oil. Gasoline goes from about 7 RVP in the summer, PSI, to about 15 in the winter. It changes over the seasons. So you can sort of see how these sort of line up from a standpoint. So these are all flammable liquids. They're shipped in tank cars currently. They're designed to handle 100 PSI. So we're looking at a range right now, 0 to 15, tank car up to 100. So I would say the issue of volatility is a little off target, because in effect these are well below any limit of the tank car. And also this issue of volatility comes up when you talk about ethanol. Ethanol, very low volatility product. It's homogeneous. It's not heterogeneous. It's all the same substance. It's also shipped in unit trains because we're using a lot of ethanol in our gasoline. So ethanol and crude oil are the two big sources. If you were to look at volatility as your only measure, you might not look at ethanol. The regulators might not look at ethanol. But there have been a number of unit train accidents involving ethanol. That clearly suggests that there's something other than volatility driving this. This is it's a flammable liquid. So we're focused in our activities on crude oil. The regulators are actually looking at more broadly, looking at crude oil and ethanol. And I actually think the better way to look at it is these unit trains that we're talking about. What is a unit train? I mean, we say, because we are shipping more volumes of these. So we're shipping 100 tank car unit trains.
Most of the rules are geared toward trains that carry at least 1 million gallons.
Yeah, the DOT proposal, I think, of 20. We don't think the DOT regulator gets it quite right. But we understand what they're trying to do.
And they also call these trains high-hazard flammable trains.
Yeah. So I think off the tongue.
Yeah, it does. Lois?
So I have a comment. I'm not as involved in the details of these rules as my colleagues on the panel are, but I think the big picture takeaway is that we have a new, somewhat different, somewhat similar type of material coming out of shale formations that is different than the regulatory structure that exists. And when you have something new and it's moving very fast and in terms of increased production, and the regulatory system is behind, even the voluntary standard system is behind. And so we're in a place right now where you're dealing with rail and pipeline regulatory frameworks that are inadequate, and it's very hard, as we all know, to get government structures to do something fast, but it's very much needed at this point.
Jessica, what about in Canada? You talked about the same, you basically had the same experience at Lac-Mégantic, was everyone realizing that they were dealing with something a little different.
Yeah. So I think, this is sort of to Lois's point, but with the Bakken crude, as well as with oil from the oil sands in Alberta, as the production has increased very quickly in the last years, it seems like the production increases and then the questions start. So with the Bakken crude, it was, is this more volatile? Is this more prone to explode, to burn, etc.? Is this more dangerous? And then there's a whole lot of head scratching because we don't really know. And there's studies being done, there's tests being done. You mentioned some of them. And in Canada, we had the same experience with oil from the Alberta oil sands, which is, probably everyone here knows, is really heavy bitumen that is diluted with a range of chemicals so that they can flow through a pipeline. And after it was flowing through pipelines, a lot of concerns come up about whether it is more corrosive to pipelines, whether it's more dangerous, whether the chemicals used are carcinogenic. So I think part of this is that we aren't really sure what we're dealing with, and we seem to find out, and also with the diluted bitumen is how it behaves in water when it spills, which everybody learned about in Marshall, Michigan. So we're finding out about these different, potentially different properties when something goes terribly wrong, and then we're studying it, trying to figure out what the case is.
I know the Wall Street Journal did some interesting reporting about the content of the gases. You probably know more about their reporting than I do. But part of one of the issues was whether or not you could stabilize the fuel at the source before you load it either into a pipeline or into a rail car. And I don't know if that's a one way of dealing with the volatility or the properties of the.
Well, I should give folks a little background. If you want to talk about stabilization for a second, we can. What happens is, first off, when you drill a well, take a step back, you have a range of anything from all gas to all liquid. And so depending on the formation, you get the spectrum. Oftentimes you get both gas and liquid coming out of the same well. In those cases, what you do is typically what they call, actually stable, it's called stabilization. Probably not the best term, but in effect what you're doing is at the wellhead or at the production site, you're allowing the gas, you're removing the gas, whether it's through heat treatment, off-gassing at atmosphere pressure. That gas can then either be shipped to market or it can be flared, depending on the circumstances. So, and then that liquid is then put into the pipeline, the tank car, barge, however, to move it to refineries or the market. So that's what we, when we talk about stabilization, that's what that term refers to. At this point, stabilization is primarily done for commercial purposes. It really is to meet specifications for shipment. It is not being done for safety reasons. And this is why I'll tell you I don't think it's being done for safety reasons. Again, we're trying to get this issue of reducing risk, not displacing it. If you now say, okay, fine, let's stabilize, let's strip all the gas out of every single crude oil we can find and ship it to market separately, what have you done? You've now created two separate streams. You now have created a gas, in this case, it's a flammable gas versus a flammable liquid, different shipping requirements. Then you also still have this crude oil. That's still flammable liquid. It may be lower volatility, but it's still a flammable liquid. It will still be shipped in the same containers. I don't see that as reducing the risk. I think you've displaced the risk because now you've got two different streams you have to get to market. So I don't think that that's the right way to go from a risk reduction. I don't think that's the. I think where it is done, I think it's done for commercial reasons. And I think it should continue to be done that way going forward.
Okay, well, I'm a little late on this. I think we really need to open this up to the audience. The rules I've been given are you have to be a working journalist. Because there are a lot of advocacy groups, and we love you, but we want to keep this to work in journalism. Okay?
I'm Rachel Gleason. I'm with the Environmental Program out in West Texas. And in the Permian Basin region, we have a lot of problem with oil field theft. The joke is that you can just get a white truck and drive onto any site. 2 years ago in Texas, we also had a man who was arrested for trying to blow up a pipeline in Plano. And so you're tasked with preventing accidents, but how do you deal with the security threats, both physical and cyber threats?
I have to beg pre-ignorance, and if you want to follow up on that, clearly, obviously, cyber is an issue, as is physical security for our facilities. I'd have to get back to you about what we're doing on both of those. I just honestly just don't have the information to address that for you.
Is there any regulatory...
Would you identify yourself?
Oh, I'm Michelle Nyhaus. I'm with National Geographic. Is there any regulatory coordination between pipeline safety regs and rail safety regs? Or are the decisions... Are those just commercial decisions as to how to transport...
Well, we're both under the Department of Transportation.
Okay. Right, and the pipeline safety... The PHMSA, the Pipeline Hazardous Material Safety Administration... And the Federal Railroad Administration also they jointly did this characterization classification testing study, and they're all involved in this advanced rulemaking, the proposed rulemaking the DOT has put out. So I would go to the DOT website and cultivate some contacts there.
Bobby McGill from Climate Central in New York. This is for Bob. I'm wondering if you can talk about the long-term use of rail for transporting back and crew. What's your take on the long-term use of rail, particularly if the Keystone XL pipeline is not built, because there's the spur that goes from the back end to the Keystone?
Yeah, you mentioned a couple of things. First off, as I mentioned, we have a very diverse and dynamic shipping system. We use crude, we use pipelines, we use rail, we use barges. Sometimes we use all three on the exact same route to get to refiners and market. It's that way for enough. There are strengths to that. There are probably some weaknesses to that approach as well. But I do think it's proven to be a safe way of moving the crude oil. I think, again, we can improve it. We're not at zero. We can certainly make improvements on all of those, and we need to look at that. I think rail is going to be here as an important element going forward. You mentioned Keystone. Keystone, most people focus on Keystone, 800,000 barrels per day. It's supposed to move primarily oil sands. The Trans-Canada said that they would devote about 100,000 barrels per day for Bakken. So I think they don't have fully committed yet, but you've got that. So that would be additional pressure off rail to move it to market. There are also other pipelines in the works, particularly for Canadian crude as well as Bakken crude. As we all know, pipelines, we've had some issues getting pipelines approved in this country. And this month we're celebrating the 6th anniversary of Keystone not being approved. 6th anniversary is a candy anniversary, by the way. We looked it up. So I think the challenge is a regulatory challenge here, because I think we would like the oil and gas industry would use pipelines. We'll use the available methods of transportation, and we're going to need them all. I think you're going to continue to see growth in both. When you mentioned the Bakken, we're about a million barrels per day of production in the Bakken right now. I think by 2020, it's projected we'll go to 2 million barrels per day of the Bakken. So. Again, similar growth in oil sands. There's going to be continued growth there. So, yes, it will get to market, and I think rail is going to play an important part, because no one wants to. We're just talking going north-south. We're not talking to the refineries in the East Coast, which would really benefit from the Bakken crude, right, as they do now.
And companies like Plains, the company I was dealing with, as Bob has explained to me, midstream company, and it has investments in barge services. It owns leases rail cars, et cetera.
So you're seeing companies are sort of what they call midstream, in effect, handling the whole gamut of transportation.
Right. You have a question.
I have a question about pipelines, Sarah Terry Cobo, the Journal Record newspaper, Oklahoma City. So in Oklahoma, we've got a handful of different plays that are very active, lots of them in rural areas. And the pipelines that I'm interested in are not the crude and gas pipelines. I'm interested in if API or if the advocacy group has any suggestions, recommendations for produced water pipelines, freshwater pipelines, and recycled water pipelines. We have seen some development by some of the larger independents. Mom and pops don't have the capacity to do that, but we do see a lot of water recycling the flow back and produced water, and they're actually putting it in pipelines, the lay flat kind of temporary pipelines that they can move around. But there are no regulations in place. It's all kind of a voluntary, we're going to do the right thing because that's our motto. But do you have any recommendations for how to move forward on that?
I hate to have a complete ignorance. I'm the downstream guy. I honestly am not as familiar on some of the produced water issues. Okay. So I don't know.
Yeah, it's an issue that I used to be on the Federal Advisory Committee for oil pipelines for the federal government, and I did a whole presentation to the committee. Everybody acknowledged this is and it's essentially non-regulated at the federal level. In Alaska, we've done some good work making only two sets of pipelines. There's transmission pipelines and piping associated with the well, so everything else is regulated. Federally, only transmission pipelines are regulated. So there are ways to deal with this. The whole term gathering pipeline, everybody's got their own interpretation, which means from a regulatory standpoint, it's kind of useless because you can't enforce it. I'd love to talk to you further, but there's some historical reasons for this. But I agree with you. There's a huge need for some effort. And to the extent that people dig into state databases, which I've done, sounds like maybe you have as well, you can see that there are lots of problems associated with this because they are kind of out there. It's the Wild West. There's no good rules for that. From our perspective, we'd like to see reinjection. We'd like to see it regulated because it could cause ecological problems, and you know, it's called produced water, and sometimes, again, you hear the statistic that it's, you know, 90%+ water. Well, that other, the remainder, really is what causes the problems, and that is a misleading statement in terms of putting the emphasis not where it should be.
Okay, the back.
Yeah, Valerie Brown, freelancer from Oregon. I wondered if Mr. Greco and anybody else who wants to respond could talk about the issue of energy independence. In the Northwest, we're looking at a huge increase in, I think, both oil and coal trains coming down the Columbia River Gorge and possibly liquefied natural gas. And this is all for export to China. And from people on the West Coast point of view, the stuff's going to go over there, they're going to burn it, and the pollution is going to come back over and just fall right down on us on the West Coast. And I heard that the energy independence argument is kind of a red herring because most of this increase in production is for export.
Sure, I'm happy. First off, I don't use the word energy independence because I don't think you'd ever be truly energy independent. Energy self-sufficiency, I think, is achievable. Because in effect, Bob, by self-sufficiency, I mean, again, when we talk about primarily North America, it's producing what we need in the continent, in the North American continent. That those oil prices, oil is a global commodity. It's going to be traded globally. It'll be subject to global price fluctuations. So ultimately, you know, there's no doubt that the oil economy is interrelated. But I do think when you look at the benefits of our domestic production, just all you have to do is look at what's going on right now in the Middle East. And a number of reports, even EIA, the Energy Information Administration, just recently reported that basically the increase in U.S. domestic production has offset the loss in oil production in the Middle East because of the tensions and strife over there. What would that have done to prices? I don't know. But the fact is prices have come down. That's as a result of that, of this production. So we can use our own oil. We can also export it, exporting its value. There's a lot of interest now. People don't want to be relying on Russia, surprise, for oil and natural gas. That's some, there are geopolitical benefits to us, to the U.S. as a nation, for encouraging that type of export.
I'm sorry, Dan Grossman. I'm a freelance science reporter from Boston. Could the panelists say comment on the significance of the Kalamazoo spill for future oil sands pipeline shipments, the new pipelines that are planned?
Clearly, I think there has been some lessons learned from that, and in fact, the pipeline industry, we were working on some new standards as a result of that, working with the regulators as well. So I do think going forward, industry will continue to make improvements. Again, I've been focusing on rail safety. Pipeline safety is actually slightly better. From overall, so that's not to say we can't do a better job, and we need to continue to focus on that. But I do think it also gets this issue of, we talk about red herrings. This issue of being more corrosive, I would say, is a red herring, as far as oil sands being more corrosive. Pipelines, again, kind of like tank cars, are designed to a specification to ship products of a certain specification. And in looking at the products, the specs of Canadian crude oil, it's well within the range of the pipeline specs. Again, the pipeline zone, they operate, they maintain that. So we don't see that as an issue in the context of shipping Canadian crude oil by pipeline.
What do you think, Jessica?
I think that spill is the Lac-Megantic of pipelines.
What's that?
It's the Lac-Megantic of pipelines. Last year, there was Enbridge, same company, a sister line to Line 6B, which ruptured in Michigan. There was a proposal to reverse and increase the flow of it. It runs from Sarnia to Montreal in Canada. I sat through all of the public hearings on that, and Kalamazoo was the never-ending refrain. So, I think it showed us how devastating it can be, and it also showed us that the regulatory systems, what was being done was not adequate to ensure safety. I mean, I imagine most people here are fairly familiar with what the NTSB report said about Enbridge and about that pipeline. And I think for existing projects or sort of retrofits to existing projects, that's something as journalists that we should read. and then ask those questions. And certainly with Line 9 in Toronto, you know, I read the NTSB report and then went to Enbridge and said, okay, well, what about this? And how do you do this? And how do you do this? Because there's so many similarities. And we got a lot of really good stories out of it.
And I would say, for those of you who don't know, there's been $1 billion spent on cleanup of the Kalamazoo River. That is an enormous amount, and it's basically because the dilbit, once the volatiles go up, the oil remains that remains sinks, and so it is different than conventional cruel. And I guess I would respectfully disagree with Bob on this. We don't know enough about the characteristics of the oil sands crude that is going through our pipelines and whether there is all the compatibilities that we need, whether the regulations are enough. And then I would add to that, because cleanup is so problematic, and I don't think there's any debate there, if you can't do a good job of cleanup, that's got to affect the decision-making in terms of whether you move it through.
Just really quickly respond. I think you'll notice, we've noticed that either the crude oil, again, it's too light or it's too heavy. There are problems with this. Crude oil, it runs a range of API gravity, and Canadian crude oil is not heavier than some California crudes. It's not heavier than some Middle Eastern crudes. Bakken crude is not lighter than some shale crudes in the Gulf. It's not lighter than some Saudi Arabian-like crudes. They're crude oil. There's a range of specs, yes, and we need to make sure to look at the ones that are important and actually matter if you're looking at shipping requirements. But I want you to keep people focused on this when you talk about crude oil and what you're actually dealing with here.
Okay, we're running short, so real quick.
Robert Steen, I'm an independent media producer in Oregon. From our region of the country, there's a lot of opposition to Metro's infrastructure and accelerating the infrastructure to transport and support the accelerated development of the chemical. And I wonder if the two pipelines proposed to go across British Columbia, the Enbridge, and the Kinder Morgan pipelines, if they're stopped, and it's a very good likelihood that at least the Enbridge pipeline will be stopped because the tribes are getting more and more rights asserted. And if the oil terminal in Vancouver, Washington, right across the Columbia River from Portland, is stopped, there's an awful lot of momentum to stop that. And this infrastructure is not going to be in place. So what do we do with all the oil? What do we do about rethinking maybe why we need to produce so much oil?
I shouldn't be directed. I'm sorry.
Well, I'm actually, as everybody said, well, we need, you know, it's good that our oil production is growing. So I'd like to hear this.
Well, I would argue that we need to produce the right amount of energy in the right places in the right way. And given that we have a disproportionate amount of greenhouse gases associated with the oil sands oil, and we have a number of problems, I agree there needs to be some more research about whether we accurately characterize whether these materials can be transported safely, and that's different than environmentally friendly. Safety is one factor, and environmentally friendly is another. That should go into the decisions, but it's a big question, and we don't have much time to go into it in
the
great detail.
The gentleman in the third row, as he's been heading this time for a while.
Sure.
Last question.
You kind of referenced this in the beginning, Mike, but yeah, I'm just, as I've been sitting here, I've seen, I get a lot of stuff coming in my emails, at Mike Casey with Fortune, and I've seen like five or six stories even out today on rail cars, whether it be shortage of rail cars, this issue with grain and oil. Just like a report that says, you know, U.S. crude by rail shipments that are at record levels. I mean, if for someone like me who's not covered it at all, where do I get started?
Well, I think that's a great question. I think from my perspective, having been in your shoes a few months ago, you go to the industry, the Railroad Administration, the American Association of Railroads has a lot of information about it, the Petroleum Institute. We went from, I think, less than 5,000 rail cars in 2006 to more than 400,000 rail cars last year. I mean, that's the kind of increase we're talking about. It caught the attention of both of our U.S. senators in Virginia, Mark Warner and Tim Kaine. Mark Warner had a rail safety forum almost immediately after the Lynchburg accident. I would say, and I appreciate Bob being here for the oil industry, the railroad people aren't here.
or the barge people, but I would suggest to you also that you find out the degree of inspection of tracks in your state. In Virginia, you have the Federal Railroad Administration, I think, has two people, inspectors for the state. The State Corporation Commission, developed a pipeline and rail safety office some years ago. They have a small staff also, and they sort of augment what the FRA does. I think we're going to find out. I just got the kill notice. We're going to find out that probably it was a rail defect that caused the Lynchburg derailment. So I'll be happy to talk to you afterwards in terms of reporter resources. But I want to thank everybody. This is a good discussion. Thank you.